Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Wherever you are in the world, I'm Russell Tovey.
I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling modern. Ooh. And I mean modern in the sense of futuristic, super stylish, because there is actually a link to an evil scientist from Barbarella, which is obviously one of my favourite movies ever. And quite aptly, I've just literally run here from the gallery because we just had a little champagne drink with all my colleagues because we launched Catherine Bernhardt's new prints today and they've almost completely sold out. And there's a little link there, which we will explore later on in the show. But I also thought champagne was quite apt for today's guest because when I was growing up, I was obviously born in 1980. I remember my dad very clearly saying to me that the Beatles for him were like a kind of very influential force in the whole of his childhood and growing up, and like a kind of cultural force. And he said to me when I was very young, and it always stuck with me, that like Duran Duran, the pop band, the rock band, were the equivalent of what the Beatles were for him, because I was obsessed with them growing up. They were like my heroes and pretty much led to the whole of what happened in my life in my 20s in my band. And today we have a founding member of Duran Duran, actually one of the original two members that sort of had the brainwave and the genius to come together and form the band. So I am super excited, as you can hear. I would like to welcome to Talk Art, Nick Rhodes.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. It's very nice to be here with you.
How are you today?
Good, 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 good. You know, given the circumstances that we've all been enduring, I'm feeling a little more hopeful now that maybe there'll be a little sunlight.
Indeed, yeah. Where are we speaking to you from?
I'm in London.
Ah, cool.
Yeah. Have you got out to a pub beer garden yet? Or
not really my kind of thing, but I have walked past an awful lot of people in pub beer gardens. They seem to be cropping up on the street, though. That beer gardens have actually become beer pavements, I think.
That's totally true. So what Rob was saying, there is an affinity because Rob is a keyboardist and you yourself are the world's most foremost keyboardist. And you were self-taught as well, which Rob is. So you have that affinity. So you were a massive inspiration. You're talking to one of your kind of protégés here.
Not as talented, though, sadly, I don't think.
I think the thing is with keyboards, you know, I've never thought of myself as a pianist. I can play a little, of course, but piano is a very different instrument to a synthesizer. And that's really what I started with and where I still am. They fascinate me because they can be absolutely anything you want, even a 17-foot stuffed giraffe if you really want.
You can turn it into a keyboard. That's completely true. Well, we all know your music, but it'd be fantastic today to go into the art side of you, which most people might not know about. But you were born in Birmingham and you grew up wanting to be an artist to the point where you actually became an art student, right?
Well, I didn't actually even get that far. I did want to become an art student. John Taylor, my friend who I knew since I was 10 years old and whom I formed the band with, was at art school when he was 2 years older than me. So I actually left comprehensive school at the age of 16 and thought I didn't have time to go to art school because the band would be my art school. And that's how it turned out. And John was at art school which so he's very authentic, and it was very useful because our first gig was at Birmingham Polytechnic at his art school, and we were able to go there and make all our posters, which John designed, and we could go and print them all off, and you know, it's quite useful, really.
Did you know what sort of art at that point you thought you were going to make if you were to get that far?
Well, I suppose, you know, there were certain people that were already quite large in my art life, Andy Warhol being the most obvious one. But I liked a lot of the pop art period, Lichtenstein to a degree, Rauschenberg. Not so much Jasper Johns for me, but that period was interesting. But I also like a lot of classical art, you know, the sort of Baroque period from Naples, you know, all those incredible paintings, Caravaggio, Giuseppe de Ribera, all those sort of things. So I've sort of always got one foot in very classical and another one in more contemporary. And, you know, I would have made contemporary art for sure because I definitely can't paint like Caravaggio. But could I muster a few screen prints? I think I probably could at some point.
No, I was going to say. So fame came early to you. Was it around 17?
Yeah.
So you got sort of famous around 17, 18, right?
Yeah, I guess so. We started the band when I was 16.
Yeah.
And then yeah, by the time I was 18, we were doing okay.
Wow. So I've read that when you got to New York, when it was kind of the British invasion, or as it's been referred to as Anglo disco, when that kind of got to New York, you had an assistant that she said to you, "What do you want to do while you're here?" And you said, "I want to go up the Empire State Building and I want to meet Andy Warhol." And then what happened?
Well, I was just, an optimistic and somewhat flippant young man from Birmingham. And it was the first time I'd been to New York City. And so somebody asked me, I thought, well, if you don't ask, you don't get. But I didn't think for one single second that you could even go up the Empire State Building. It hadn't occurred to me that you could, because it was this sort of mythical building, wasn't it, in Gotham City. And it still is in my mind. And Andy Warhol, of course, I didn't dream that we'd be meeting him, but our PR girl, the lovely Doreen D'Agostino, wherever she may be, who quickly became known as Doreen, she said, "Okay, guys, fine." And I thought she was joking the next morning when she called me up in the hotel and said, "Okay, can you be down here at noon or whatever it was?" I said, "Why? It's our day off. I want to go out and see New York." And she said, "Well, I thought you wanted to go up the Empire State Building and meet Andy Warhol. So we're going to go and do that. And then we're going to have lunch with Andy at the factory."
Oh, my God.
So yeah, I picked up my jaw off the floor and then put on an outfit and an attitude and off we went.
But that's, I mean, what was that like? And talking about an outfit, obviously, this is something that's really important to you. You started collecting designer clothing like Yoji Yamamoto and brands like that, like male designers like that. Well, can you remember what you wore and what was that experience like?
Well, I can remember, but purely because there are photographs.
Right.
Okay.
So, I had a nice little blue Pinto number on. Pinto used to be a fabulous clothing boutique on the King's Road in London. And it was a little blue suit with a bolero jacket and a blue and white striped T-shirt, because we decided for some reason that we were going to be big on striped T-shirts that season. There are pictures from that first meeting that exist. Andy was great. He couldn't have been more encouraging and funny. Intelligent, of course, and showed us everything at the factory. But it was quite surreal because you walk in and there's Bridget sitting at the desk, and there's Fred Hughes over there, and there's all these people that I'd read about in all these books were just there.
Wow.
I actually became good friends with Andy until he passed away, very sadly. But He was quite something.
And you were obviously his favourite from everything that I read. But like he was like
we got along very well, and you know, it was for me. I was just a kid, and I looked up to him for the things that he'd done. I've always been drawn more towards people that go across multiple mediums, you know, art, cinema, music, design. And of course, Andy had made the films with Paul Morrissey and all the short films, and he'd done the design before very early on. His beautiful early drawings, I love when he was doing advertising stuff, and then of course all the prints and paintings that everybody knows. And so he really, I was drawn to that, and also my other sort of favorite artist, very different than Andy, but who I used to talk about a lot with Andy, is Jean Cocteau.
Oh, wow.
Right, yeah.
And Andy was a massive fan of Cocteau too. Mm. And if you look at Andy's early drawings, actually...
Totally, yes. Yeah.
They're pretty close to the style of the Cocteau drawings. So yeah, and for the same reasons, I love what Cocteau did with cinema, and I think he's almost the singular most underrated painter and artist from that period. I think it's more to do with jealousy than anything else, that he was that good at that many different things that some people just won't accept that the drawings are that good, or the paintings. But anyway, yes. So I think that's really what drew me to that scene. And music, of course, Andy and the Velvet Underground, I should mention.
Yeah, of course. I always remember seeing amazing photos of Cocteau. An ex of mine was related to a woman that was very close to Cocteau. I've forgotten her name, but she was like a performance artist or something. And there's loads of pictures of them. But he had a thing that you guys had in a way, this kind of sense of self and persona that like really translates into imagery and then music videos that in your era, you know, like that whole kind of way that you could have this very precise sense of self and confidence and cool. And I always remember like that kind of solid vision of how you present yourself. Was that something that came natural to you? Because I was watching the Netflix documentary that's now on Netflix. I think originally it was in 2018, about the history of the band, just a few nights ago. And I was really struck by all of you. To this day, you just have this kind of very self kind of confident way of being. Like, it's very rare.
I suppose it must be natural because I never thought about it. I mean, it's I don't know. What I do think about a lot is presentation with everything we do. And I really do mean everything, because the typeface, the smallest typeface on the label that you need a magnifying glass to read, still matters to me every bit as much as everything else, as every note on the record, as everything on the sleeve, as every light that moves in the show, and every frame of the video that's behind us. And I think that John is very much part of the aesthetic squad with me. And so we've always tried to look at our presentation in a very particular way. And we learned that from the great artists that came before us, from the likes of David Bowie and Roxy Music and Sparks and Cockney Rebel and the other glam rock acts, T-Rex from the 70s. And then of course, punk rock, which had the most incredible aesthetic. And so mix that in with a bit of craft work and Giorgio Moroder, and somewhere you end up in the cauldron with Duran Duran.
Mm. But it reminds me of a quote in a Guardian interview you did, where it says, I always judge a bottle of wine by its label. It shows that it's made by people who care about the tiniest details. So that...
Still, well, I would never buy a record that I didn't like the cover of. I couldn't bring myself to do it. And usually I would think exactly the same thing. If they haven't bothered with the cover, then I don't think I'm going to like what they're doing.
That's so cool. That's I love awesome. That. I also think it's really interesting because, in fact, like Duran Duran could have been a kind of indie rock band, you know, that would have been in the NME almost. But instead, it went into a very different realm of like super pop culture, you know, where you had like screaming girls chasing you all around the world. Mm. And it's so interesting because I actually think you guys changed things for the better because you took these kind of values and precision and, you know, actually having quality in what you do into the mainstream, which is such an unusual kind of thing.
It was a strange way that it came about because we really were sort of the children of glam rock and punk rock,
yeah,
and electronic music. And so when we formed the band, the first album is a mixture of electronic music and disco and a little bit of rock in there too.
Mm.
It's quite diverse. If you think on that album, there is a 7-minute orchestral and electronic piece with no vocals at all, apart from a little moaning, called Tel Aviv. And that sits alongside Planet Earth, Girls on Film, mm-hmm. Waiting for the Night Boat,
yeah.
And of Thunder. So we set our boundaries extremely wide. From the beginning, we didn't want to get fenced in. My nightmare would be to be in a band that has a guitar, bass, drums, and one keyboard player, but they just play the same thing all the time. I wouldn't have lasted past, well, probably half an hour. But with us, I think the beauty of Duran Duran and why we're still here and why we are all still enthusiastic enough to want to continue is because we are very adaptable and flexible. A couple of tours ago, we all decided to come to the front of the stage and play keyboards. Well, Roger had electronic drums in our homage to Kraftwerk.
Mm-hmm.
Not many sort of rock bands or bands generally that I think have that type of flexibility, that like disco as much as they like rock music or ambient music.
Mm. Well, it feels like you have that affinity with Andy Warhol and the fact that he was very forward thinking. He was very embracing of the future and wanting to know everything. And like you were testament to, you know, before MTV culture, you really pushed the fact that the visuals, the music videos had to be something special when a lot of people weren't really paying that much attention to that side of, you know, yeah, the marketing.
They were like mini films, weren't they? They were like these adventures, yeah. You'd sort of go on and very exotic and like glamorous and, I don't know, like exciting.
If you go to a bunch of fairly young kids and say, you know, you've got to make a film to go with your music that you've just made and here's a budget, that's what happens.
Yeah. What about Rio, the album cover? Because that's one of my favorite bits in the documentary. Same. Is where you find the painting again.
I haven't seen the documentary.
You know what I must just say about the documentary?
I'm not so good at watching things once we've done them, but I thought the director who did it, Zoe, was great. So I hope it turned out well. The painting was Patrick Nagel, who a California artist who sadly died at a very young age. But it's a very specific look. It's almost got a bit of Art Deco to it. But it summed up the 80s to me. I, at the time, it had that energy and the color that I don't think people use sort of purple and lilac like that anymore, do they really? But then it seemed just right. And when I saw that image with the smile on her face, it makes you smile when you look at it. And she's aging very well. She looks just the same to me.
Yeah. Well, it's an Art Deco like pop art feel, but Patrick Nagel emphasized the female form throughout all of his kind of imagery. So that, and it's become iconic. But what was it like? See, we talk about the 80s then. What was it like being part of this kind of pop moment, this moment in history, and being famous at 17? What in the 80s? What was that like?
I have great memories and no real regrets. It's the thing about the 80s that now in hindsight I think we can see is that it was a decade of invention. People were not afraid to do something different. In the 80s, when you walked down the street, you wanted to stand out. Mm. By the time we got to the 90s, it was all about having that particular pair of trainers and that pair of jeans. For me, that was not interesting. What was interesting was having Terry Mugler, Claude Montana, Anthony Price, Vivian Westwood, Yoji Yamamoto, Comme des Garçons, Jean-Paul Gaultier, all at the same time, creating these remarkable things. Not to say we didn't have amazing things in the 90s with Galliano and McQueen, of course, incredible. But in the 80s, it was more diverse almost. And that's fashion, but you had the same with music. You know, our contemporaries, if you look at things in the charts, sometimes you'd have U2, INXS, The Smiths, us, and you'd still have The Cure and Susie and the Banshees, and alongside a lot of pop stuff, and it was really, it didn't matter. We all existed alongside each other and made whatever we wanted. Everybody had their own personality. If I have any criticism at all of music now, it's that I hear so much that sounds the same. It really does. It sounds like they've got it out of a tin and just poured it onto the vinyl, or not even that far often, just onto the little digital chip, and use the same things. And it's just not interesting. What's interesting is when people do something different, when people do something completely unique. And I suppose really that's my thought about the 80s on most levels. It was like that.
I think one of the reasons I loved Duran Duran so much was that it is kind of conceptual. You know, it's not just about here we are as songwriters and we're going to like pour our hearts out to you, even though you are all extraordinary songwriters and Simon's an amazing singer. But for me, I, for example, your 90s album, like with Come Undone on, I remember when I first saw that sleeve and it really confused me, because back then in the early 90s onwards, post 80s, you had like basically people on the front covers, you know, posed in some kind of way. And there were some people that would do it quite cool, like Madonna, because she'd always find an amazing photographer to like shoot her, but it would still be her on the cover. And I really liked that album sleeve. And to me, I see you guys as more like curators or something. You would like pick out collaborators or artists to actually highlight and take to another audience.
Well, I think we've always sort of seen ourselves as more of an art project than a band. Because there's so many different things. You know, we're lucky that we get to work with great people too. I always say that, you know, you can make something good, but when you collaborate with someone really great too, it makes it even better. You know, when I was a kid and I was going to Birmingham Arts Lab to watch movies with John Taylor, and we went to see this movie called Eraserhead, which was David Lynch's first full-length movie.
Yeah.
And it completely blew me away. I was opened up to another world that I didn't know existed out there. But that was when I was, I don't know, about 14 or something. And then several decades later, we find ourselves making a film with David Lynch.
Wow.
He made our live film for us, which was such a thrill, because I'm a great admirer of his work and what he does. And he's another person that is very like-minded. He's got great references, but he's futuristic the way he thinks about things. And he works in paintings, he works in music, he works in film. He's a great artist.
Wow. So when you started making money, you had the wherewithal to invest in art. You started collecting art at a very young age. How did you know to kind of do that, and where did you start with that?
I started by buying things I liked, which is not, I suppose, the right way to invest necessarily, because the art world now is more used much more as currency than taste and style. And I think then I just bought things that I wanted to put on my wall, which I still have some of. Think prints. I bought a Dali print when I was about 17, I think, which,
oh my God.
It wasn't terribly, terribly expensive, but for me, it was a lot of money then with what I earned. And,
why Dali?
I don't know. I just saw it and I loved it. I love surrealism too. That's the other thing. That period to me, again, ideas. People had so many magical ideas. I mean, now, you know, there are artists out there. There are people, of course, that come up with great things and concepts. But I think it was Simon de Puri who said the other day that somebody had asked him once whether he was drawn to art as a physical thing or an intellectual thing. Mm. I said physical. I would also say physical. It doesn't mean that I don't like lots of concept art and intellectual things. I do, but I don't have any particular wish to put conceptual pieces in my house. I don't need a bunch of bricks on the floor in a circle or whatever it is. I'd rather have a painting to look at if it's a beautiful painting. Yeah. But anyway, it's interesting the way things have gone now, I suppose, when you look at the Beeple.
The like, NFTs, yeah.
And things like that. It's not. I'm not against the concept. I think it's probably being manipulated rather a lot at the moment. But in theory, the fact that people issue things and say there's only X amount and that you don't have to hang them on your wall, you've just got an ownership in them. I get that concept completely. I don't suppose it's much different in some ways than Marcel Duchamp going and buying a load of shovels and signing them, is it? And saying, right, this is mine now. Or multiple editions of screen prints, not even made directly by the artist, made by Murakami's factory or Damien Hirst's factory or whatever it is. The art is there for people to do whatever they want with it and to get whatever enjoyment out of what they buy or what they look at. You don't have to buy art. I spend most of my time in galleries looking at art. I don't have to own it. But of course, it's nice to have good things on your walls and things that make you happy, things that inspire you.
I've got Andy Warhol's diary here, and you feature a lot. There's lots of entrances for Nick Rhodes. But on Monday, September 17th, 1984, there is a section where he says, "And Nick Rhodes buys art, but he doesn't listen to anybody. And I told him that it's stupid not to, that it's just like buying stocks. But he said, I just buy what I like."
There you go. See, some things haven't changed. But you see, Andy was right. You know, he saw all this coming. He would have he would have known exactly what the NFT thing was. God, I wish he'd seen the internet. I really, really do. That would have been quite something, because he would have viewed it in a way that nobody else had thought about.
Yeah, him on Instagram. Can you imagine? Andy Warhol on Instagram would have just been like...
He left the house. He barely left the house because he was frightened of missing things on TV. But,
Did you once buy Picasso on an Amex?
Yeah.
You did?
Oh, my God. That's hilarious.
Where was that? What was that story?
I was in St. Paul de Vence, I think, in the south of France. And it was just a little tiny... tiny
masterpiece.
I wouldn't have said it was a masterpiece, but it was a tiny little crayon drawing. I had that for a while. I don't have that one anymore. So it's one of the few pieces that I parted company with because it didn't seem to be sitting right.
Did you go to La Colombe d'Or, the hotel in Saint Paul de Vence?
Many times, yeah.
Yeah, because I've never been there. I've always wanted to go. Oh, that's a classic, isn't it?
They have an amazing art collection.
Yeah.
Really extraordinary, beautiful things in there. Yeah.
We've been invited actually to go with Talk Art to sort of go and stay at the hotel and talk about the art. Because don't they have like Calder sculptures by the pool and stuff?
Yeah, over the pool. Yeah.
So cool.
Over the pool?
Yeah. It's like, and they used to do things where they would like take the artworks and then they were almost like to barter. And then the artist would stay and have food and also get to like stay the night exchange for the art.
Oh, no, it's extraordinary. There's all kinds of things. There's a beautiful Legere mural in the wall, I think. And, there's all kinds of things, Picassos and Bracks. And you'll enjoy it. It's great. It's really
You know, you mentioned Damien Hirst there a minute ago, and that first time I ever met you was actually at one of Damien's openings, which was that very extraordinarily kind of strange moment in 2008. And it was just before the financial crisis. I think it literally the next day, the whole of the banking system collapsed sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, it was just wild. And I remember standing in there, and for some reason you walked over to me and we stood and ended up sort of hanging out for about half an hour. And the first time we said hi to each other, we were stood by a sculpture on the wall that was all cigarettes, and it was cigarettes in lines, like
in the cabinet.
Yeah, in a cabinet. And the room was shaking because there were so many people in there. And it was this really extraordinarily odd moment where I think Jay Jopling had been talking to us, and then he sort of was a bit confused who I was and walked off. And then you and I were sort of didn't know each other, but we were stood there and we were looking at this sculpture, and it was shaking. And in my memory, one of the cigarettes fell off like the perch it was on. And I can't remember if I've made that up as a memory, whether it's actually real.
No, I think you're right. That's the thing. He should have used pins, shouldn't he?
And I remember us talking about
butterflies. Yeah. You would have thought that he got a pinning technique down, but no, all just
yeah, and it fell off. And then I also remember you telling me that one of your favourite works by him, I think it was you, was his drawings of the cigarettes, or something about his drawings and how they were like, I don't know, like, I can't remember now.
I like some of Damien's things. I actually quite like the black paintings he made that looked like Francis Bacon's.
Mm. Oh, right, yeah.
The recent Scott ones.
That was a nice series.
Yeah. We're talking about that hotel where you were bartering. There is, I would like a little history lesson now about the power of Mr. Chow's Chinese restaurant, which is on 57th Street in New York and became the place for the art community, for music and for film people to hang out. And there's photos that appear from 1985 from Andy Warhol's birthday party there, which you were at, where you're sat with Keith Haring and you're sat with David Hockney and you're sat with Grace Jones and Andy Warhol. What was the power? Why did Mr. Chow's become so synonymous with this period in history?
Well, it was just the restaurant that everybody went to hang out at it in New York. The first Mr. Chow's was London. It was the one in Knightsbridge. Mm. Then I don't know what years they opened, but Michael and Tina Chow, Michael, who lives in LA now and he paints himself, had opened the restaurant. So Tina was a very, very dear friend of mine, whom I met through Andy, actually. And we just all used to meet up there. If you went there on your own or with a couple of people, you know that you'd know half the people there. It was all that crew, Francesco Clemente and Alba and Andy and Jean-Michel and Keith and Kenny Scharf. And it was, you know, all those artists, Julian Schnabel. It was that period where there were a lot of great things. New York was really the center of art at that point, as London became that center with Brit art. Mm. I think really the 80s then belonged to New York. And it was always fascinating because there was other people too. Stephen Sprouse was always there, and who I adored, and Debbie Harry, and you know, it was an interesting crowd. I suppose when you'd been there and you saw all those people, you didn't really need to go to the other. But there were other restaurants. We sometimes used to go to Odeon or Cafe Luxembourg or. There were other ones, Il Cantinori, you know. The restaurants become fashionable for periods, don't they? And then they get taken over sometimes by other fashionable people or otherwise dropped.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
What's it like when you're sat at dinner with sort of like six other super important people from kind of culture? Is it just very ordinary? Are they just like very down-to-earth people, or is it, or do you sit there sometimes and you think, oh my God,
yourself,
what is this?
Like, what is this world?
It crazy?
I don't know. I'm always fascinated by other artists that I admire, so I'm happy to meet them and happy to hang out with them and to share ideas, share stories, whatever it is. Andy was certainly the center of that group, no question, but there was a lot of talented people around then who were all doing slightly different stuff as well. And I think curiosity is important in life, especially if you're an artist, and that's one of the things that for sure drives me to do whatever I want to do next. That's how I ended up at this Astronomia project, which perhaps we talk about in a second. I think that being around people that are inspiring can only generate more inspiration for you as an artist. Right. No, especially people that are hugely successful already, or some people that are coming up. It's nice to watch people. You know, I'd met Jean-Michel before he'd really become anywhere near what he became even in his lifetime. And then to think what has happened subsequently after he left us is...
What was he like?
Mind-boggling. I love Jean-Michel. He was really gentle and sweet and sometimes a little moody, but he had a lot of people pulling on his tails all the time, saying, "Come over here, come do this, come do that." But he did everything his way, and that's why he was so great at it. I think he was uncompromising. He didn't like being messed around by people. But he was intelligent, and he was a proper artist through and through.
And Keith Haring, you hung out with as well, right?
Keith, yes, Keith, I knew him very well. Keith was lovely.
Yeah, because everything I've seen on him, he just seems to be so like cool and kind of cocky and really charming with it that everybody loved him.
Yeah, they did. No, he was very special, Keith. He was obsessed with famous people, Keith. That's what I remember, much more so than Andy, actually.
Yeah.
I think. But no, look, he invented his own language too. Look at what he did. It's kind of extraordinary when you think, you look at the cartoon thing and you go, okay. And at the same time, you had Kenny Scharf, who was Keith's contemporary, who also made some really beautiful things. And then you look, you know, in many ways, I look at the Jeff Koons stuff and I think, well, actually, Kenny was doing that a long, long, long time ago. And then you look at Keith's stuff and the influence that he had on people. Look at Cause. For me, that's got a lot of lot of Keith in it too.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know, what he's done is amazing. Again, he's created his own market. I met him very early on. A friend introduced us and I went over to his studio and he was so lovely. And I thought, oh, this is going to do okay, but you would never have seen that sort of growth to the monumental
superstar, international sort of
but he was very organized, and these amazing toys that he was making right from the beginning in Japan, and I'm glad we met then.
We had Cause on the show, and I love that kind of gentle quality he has. He's so kind of like quiet and thoughtful and sincere. He's a great guy. You know, another person Haring really influenced is our mutual friend Catherine Bernhardt. And the last time I saw you was at Freeze before the whole pandemic happened. I don't know, maybe 2019 now. But you came on the booth to see Catherine because she was in the UK.
Yeah.
And she's a big admirer of yours as well. And I think your band actually really inspired her kind of... I think you guys
style.
Give her strength and kind of like make her feel like a stronger person somehow. It's very sweet. Can you speak a bit about her?
Yeah, no, I like Catherine very much. We met, quite some years ago. I went to her first show in London.
Right.
I want to say it was somewhere in Knightsbridge or Belgravia or somewhere.
It was, yeah. It was some strange kind of collaboration.
Very different kind of venue.
It was her model paintings, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And yeah, I liked her. She's quirky and got a lovely energy to her, and she's got a style all of her own. You know,
she
whatever she wants, and it always ends up being hers. So yeah, no, she's great. Do send her my regards if you see her. I haven't seen her for a while.
Yeah, definitely, I will do.
Do you collect now? And how do you collect now? Do you look at emerging artists from like all around the world, or do you have a certain kind of thing that you do like zone in on?
Well, I do collect, yeah, but I'm really all over the place. I don't collect a specific thing. I'm not one of these who sort of says I've got to have, you know, one piece from each one of these sort of hot new 10 artists. I must have a Robert Nava piece now, and I've got to have that. It's not. There's lots of artists out there who I think are doing good things, but I do tend to buy slightly older things rather than new things, which goes against most things that I like to think I stand for. But I haven't bought that many modern pieces recently. I suppose one of the things that happens is that you see a lot of stuff, and you know, if you go to Frieze or any of the art fairs, and you see booth after booth after booth, you sort of go art blind.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it starts to really look the same. It's, oh, everybody's trying to do that graffiti thing, but now they're doing it with spray paint as well, and everybody's got square shoulders and a square head and sort of robot eyes. You'll see that, and then you'll see other things. There was one year I went where virtually everything was in a cabinet, like a Damien Hirst. Every booth, everything. It didn't matter what it was. You could put your grandma's glasses in there in a line, and it was fine. That was acceptable that year. So from that point of view, that's where I sort of draw my line. And then occasionally you come across someone who you think, ah, now that I like. That is different. There's a photographer that I'm particularly keen on that we've he's going to do our next album cover for us. A Japanese photographer called Daisuke Yokota.
And right.
I think he's the most inspiring modern artist of the period at the moment. You know, it's because his things are truly original, and I can see where his roots have come from, you know, out of those Japanese photographers, out of Moriyama and some of the others from that sort of 60s, 70s period. But I don't know. I bounce around from things. I'll buy things that I like, true to my form, but I'll sometimes buy older things. And if I find a great surrealist piece that I could afford, then I buy that, you know, probably more so than maybe four new modern artists.
What are the paintings behind you? Because there's some sort of portraits or...
Oh, those are the Three Wise Men.
Are they? And where did you get those? Are they canvas? Yeah.
They're Victorian. They're just for fun.
Oh, yeah, cool.
I was fed up with the wall being empty.
Right. You were talking about photography then, and you yourself are a photographer. I've read somewhere that when you released a book in 1984 of abstract manipulated Polaroid photographs that you did called Interference. But at one point on tour, you had a suitcase full of all of your Polaroids that you carried around because you were so inspired and constantly kind of creating. You're still doing that, right? And that's a thing for you.
I haven't used Polaroid as much recently, but I still love Polaroids. I take photos most days, something.
With a camera or would you say your phone?
Mostly a camera.
Right.
I do use my phone too. I mean, actually now the cameras in the phones are pretty good, as we all know, but I quite like having a camera, and I like having additional control over it. Often I leave it on manual. on automatic, but occasionally, you know, you just think, oh, actually, if I could just mess with the aperture a little bit, and then that can be kind of fun. So yeah, I do carry a camera most places with me. I'm thinking of going back to analog again because it really does still look better than any of the digital things. And even though I can smash all my pictures up in Lightroom or whatever and make them look like they were done with 35 millimeter or something, it's not quite the same. So I'm struggling with that a little bit at the moment. I may go take a step back for a while. And then, of course, they'll get scanned and digitally fiddled with anyway. So,
yeah.
Something I've always really loved about what you do is the idea of like world making. You sort of create other worlds, or, you know, you might have started in Birmingham, but everything that you did was so kind of like beyond this planet almost. I always feel like there's a kind of ambition, and that's one of the things I love in art, you know, people that can create their own universes. And can you speak a bit about your current project then, the Astronomia, because it sounds like such an interesting kind of thing and to do with astrology or like universe.
What happened was that when the world sort of moved into lockdown, I realized that this was going to be for a while, and I wanted to be able to continue working. And I don't need a lot of complicated things to work. Just some synthesizers and a sort of little production room is fine. I'd been working with a wonderful artist called Wendy Bevan, who I'd been introduced to by a mutual friend. She's a performance artist, a violinist, an extraordinary vocalist, songwriter, and a photographer. She also takes really beautiful photos, done a lot of fashion stuff. So we had a lot in common. And anyway, we got in the studio and we worked on a track for her solo album, which was a more traditional vocal-based album. We finished the album just before the whole chaos that we're now enduring. And we were going to put it out last year, but then thought, well, what's the point? Because it's going to get lost and everybody's so confused by everything that's going on and we don't know how it's all going to play out. And more than anything, she wanted to do some live shows to support it and couldn't.
Right.
So we said, all right, well, let's put that on hold, but let's continue working. And the idea was to produce some instrumentals, some unusual instrumentals that were a combination of orchestral music with live violins and analog synthesizers, and to see what we got. So we tried a few of them. We did 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and suddenly there's about 20 because they just kept pouring out. And I realized what we were doing is that it was like our diary of what was going on outside in the world, but inside our bubble. Right. And everything was getting poured into these pieces. So one day they'd be incredibly sad, and then another one a bit more hopeful, and then one that was just chaos, and then one that was really quiet and sort of thoughtful. And we were getting all these different moods. It was quite sort of schizophrenic for a while. It was all over the place and out of control, and we didn't know what was coming. Mm-hmm. But then we managed to sort of pull the strings in a little bit and get control of our personalities. And we thought about what we'd got and said, well, what is it? What's it about? And we decided to base it on the universe and mythology. Mythology from my great love of Jean Cocteau. He was the sort of inspiration from that with the Orphée trilogy and obviously a lot of his other work. But
for those who don't know, who are listening right now, can you explain what that trilogy is?
Yes, Jean Cocteau made three films in the, I guess, the 20s into the 40s, which were all based on Orphée and the myth of Orphée and Eurydice. And those films started with The Blood of a Poet, and then there's Orphée, and then The Testament of Orphée. And if you haven't seen them, I would highly recommend them because they are the most beautiful handmade art films of that period. and his inspiration being mythology, it makes for all kinds of cinematic magic tricks that he did without having to use any digital technology because it wasn't there. But anyway, so we had this inspiration from the universe, really. It was that and the stars, planets, looking up to the skies, hoping there's something else. You know, it's magical still, isn't it? If there's a beautiful night and you can see stars, if the light pollution has gone and you know, they've closed down Piccadilly Circus, then there's a little hope somewhere up there, a bright light shining. And so we use this as our sort of general storyboard. And once we did that, it really then started to accelerate. And we made loads more music. It's four albums called The Astronomia Project, volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4, all of which are coming out this year.
So amazing.
On the equinoxes and the solstices. So the next one is around June the 20th, I think. The first one came out, which is called The Fall of Saturn. The next one, The Rise of Lyra, in June, and so on. And we... we're presenting it through Instagram, which is Astronomia Volumes, where a new video to accompany the track is loaded each week. And because I love numerology too, there's 13 tracks on each album and they come out every 13 weeks, which is 52 weeks in the year. So there are 52 tracks and one new video each week for one track for the year.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
I am loving this. Mythology. This mythology thing is incredible. Numerology, you're into that. I mean, what is it about numerology that excites you?
Well, I just like mathematics, you know. I like logic and science. I've always been obsessed about science since I was a kid. You know, that's what I really believe in. I'm not religious. Science is my religion. And I don't know. I like the thought that there's other things. We have to look a little further. It hasn't done Elon Musk any harm so far, has it? I think he's really the one that's looking the furthest, actually, at the moment. It's fascinating. I grew up in the space race generation. That's right. What were the moon landing. I was a tiny little kid when the moon landing was there, and I remember it as one of my earliest memories, as if it were yesterday, just sitting there and never having been so excited as seeing this little television broadcast in flickering black and white of this guy, and then running outside and looking up, thinking he's on that planet. He's not here anymore. And I don't know. There's not many things that you can think of that are more exciting or ambitious than landing on another planet, is there? Are there really? I'd love to think there were aliens all around us. Nice, friendly ones, though, not ones that do unpleasant things to us.
Do you have any other memories from growing up in relation to art, like the first time you saw a museum or
art? Yeah, loads. We used to go on school trips from Birmingham to London. We'd go to different galleries, which I love. The National Portrait Gallery is a great treasure. If I'm walking past, I can't sort of resist dropping in just to go and say hello to the Caravaggios alone, you know.
Yeah,
I do. A lot of things. There was a gallery in Birmingham, one of the smaller independent galleries called the Icon Gallery.
Yes, I love Icon.
Yeah, that was one of the first galleries we went to. And actually, the show that was on there when I went was Dougie Fields. Was the first time I ever saw a Dougie Fields piece. And then Dougie and I became really, really good friends for the last 35 years or so. And I'm sure you're probably aware he recently passed away. Mm. So I was deeply saddened by that. I think he's one of the great unsung heroes of British art.
Yes.
He came up in that period where, you know, you had people like Alan Jones and Peter Blake that were obviously the kings and Hockney. And then there was Dougie. And Dougie sort of produced his own things and had his own style, which he remained true to until the very end. And They are kind of remarkable technical masterpieces, those paintings. I think any of you who haven't heard of Dougie Fields, go and look up his work. It's very very original, doesn't look like anybody else's, and it's very particular, but he'll be missed.
He was also incredibly generous to other artists and to musicians and all kinds of creative people, and would really like go on walks with people and like encourage people. And we had the great privilege recently of speaking with Zandra Rhodes about 4 or 5 days after he passed away, and we dedicated the episode to him. So I love what he did.
Yeah.
Did you win a national prize for window dressing when you were 12?
Yes.
Oh my God, that's so
how
good.
Was that? How was it a national prize? How was your window dressing at 12?
That is a good window.
That's because my mom and dad had, my mom really had a toy shop. Sadly, she didn't have it when I was really little and loved toys.
Toys, right.
She got it when I'd sort of grown out of toys and before I started to love toys again. But in that period, from when I was about 12 till 17 or whatever, I used to help her with the shop. And the thing I liked to do the most was do the window dressing. I did it. And for some reason, it got entered into a prize. But better still, it was a Barbie window.
Wow.
Yeah. There we go.
Love that.
There you go. So I won for a Barbie window.
Do you think, when you were talking about the new Astronomia project, the way that when you sort of had your concept about the universe, suddenly everything started to accelerate. Yeah. Is that something that you find really useful to kind of come up with this overarching theme that you can then explore, almost like a set of rules or something?
Yes, I do. I think that it's great to sort of be in the dark and see what you can make sometimes. Mm. But it's even better if you can control the lighting perfectly and be able to be in the right atmosphere to get the best out of everything. And if you've got a direction, then you're always going to win more than if you haven't. It's like making a film without a script. You can do it. And sometimes, you know, if you're Jean-Luc Godard, you make something fabulous. But other times it just ends up being a mess. Whereas you got the right script, then you can really make something very special. And that's what it was about. Because even, for example, once we got astronomy as the center of it, I started looking up things in different constellations and thinking, oh, I like that. What's that? What's Blasco effect? That's a good title. Yeah, and so that's how you find things. And I was quite well versed in mythology already, so I knew where to look and which myths we wanted to particularly look at.
What is Blasco effect?
Well, you'll have to look it up.
There we go. Okay.
that's a mission for everyone listening now. You can go out and discover
what Blasco effect is. So, Nick, we ask every guest two questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world to yourself from anywhere in the world, whatever it is, what would it be and why?
Ah, goodness, that's a tough one. What would it be? Quite like that Caravaggio that they have at it's the museum in Naples, the Capo di Monte in Naples. I think they've got one of the best Caravaggios at the end of that corridor. I actually don't know the names of all of them, but that one is quite big. You'd need good ceiling height to be able to hang that at home. But that one I really wouldn't mind. I think that those Baroque painters from that period just were the most extraordinary artists. And when I say that, it doesn't mean that I don't hold Marcel Duchamp in the same sort of esteem. I do, but it's a whole different thing. The technical skill and the ability that the Caravaggio particularly had, the light in those paintings, which is often talked about, and rightly so, it's unlike anything that you've ever seen in artworks. And I literally just marvel. Whenever I've got time, if I'm in Rome or in Naples particularly, where there's a the bigger selections of Caravaggios. I just go and look at them because they're almost like an impossibility, like they were done by an alien. They seem as if they shouldn't exist. The most beautiful, exquisite things. With modern art, I suppose, no, let's have a think. There's a lot of nice Picabias that I'd quite like.
Really?
Yeah. I like the Monster series and the and the Transparencies. I wouldn't mind one of those.
I always really like Picabia, and I remember certain people like some people don't
snobby
like
him about him. Yeah.
No, I'm not. I think he's a great master. You know, I mean, there's obviously plenty to choose from, isn't there? I think the what would I have from a Warhol? I guess the Liz, actually. I thought the Marilyn for a while, but I think the Liz is my favourite. When I saw the exhibition at the Tate Modern when it opened, which sadly not enough people got to see because it closed for half the pandemic, but I thought that was really, really beautifully curated and put together. Andy would have been proud of that. And the silver Liz just looked resplendent on the wall on its own. I think that one is a real gem from that period. There's a lot of things, isn't there?
What was it like when you did the interview cover? What was the process of that for Andy Warhol's interview series?
Well, the interview covers were done by Richard Bernstein. Uh-huh. Who, although they were sort of Warhol-looking style in a way, what it was is you have a photograph taken. In my case, Albert Watson took the photo. Then the photos were given to Richard, who would paint on them, layer them, put different bits of plastic over things, and quite an unusual technique. And then make the artwork, which they would then print the cover from. I sort of missed his things when they changed the cover, when they sort of changed editors and things. I thought it was almost a mistake to not have Richard do them. But again, he's long gone now. But he was an unusual character. He did all those early Grace Jones covers, the disco ones before nightclubbing and
I always thought that whole kind of airbrushing era was such a kind of interesting time. You know, if you think about that and the artistry behind,
I love that stuff.
Yeah,
sort of Fiorucci stuff.
And yes,
amazing. Yeah.
And even Maripol, I used to hang out with her, but I love her.
Maripol
and those silver
Polaroids.
Yeah, she was iconic. And the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
My favorite color. IKB, of course.
What?
What is that?
IKB.
What's that? Is that a space thing?
International Klein Blue.
I haven't had that one. Love that.
IKB. So that the kind of cobalt blue that he's known for, that's your favourite?
Naturally, Ross. A bit of IKB.
He actually patented that colour, I believe, long before... Anish Kapoor managed to do one, didn't he? He got a black.
Yes. No, and he's got a black,
I can only imagine that must have been inspired by Yves Klein.
Right. And that's there's a young artist now who's fighting against the Anish Kapoor black.
Yeah, well, there's another one that's made a more black, isn't there?
That's right, yes.
Black.
Yeah, exactly. And it's Stuart Semple, and it's completely like, sort of has no light or something. It's a really amazing... I don't know. He's managed to invent this new black. It's really interesting.
Some curtains. Maybe he could call me if he's got it in curtain fabric.
Oh, this has been so much fun.
Thank you so much Nick.
For
it was fun. That's good. All right. Well, I shall listen out for some of your other shows when you've got some different guests. Who have you got coming up?
Zandra Rose is going to be coming up talking about Dougie Fields, and tonight Rachel White Reed's going out, and we've got Gilbert and George, and then we've got
a whole host of people, and there's lots of younger artists coming as well that you might not necessarily know yet. We kind of balance between superstars like yourself And then
send me some tips. I'd love to. I'm always looking for new things. So definitely, if there's people, you probably are much more in the thick of it than I am.
I'm curating a show at Rob's Gallery called Breakfast Under the Tree, which is inspired by Manet's Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe. And it's a group show of international artists. So a lot of them are emerging. And I think it's figurative. It's about group figuration and how we live now. And I think you'll really like that. So I don't know if that's something you'd be interested in seeing a PDF of. Or
That's the one that Malcolm McLaren used for the Bow Wow Wow album cover, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. Yeah, nice link there. Yeah. Also, we have a book coming out, which we can post you, because that has lots of the artists that we love.
Yeah, definitely. Send me that.
Talk art book, we will do. Amazing. Well, thank you for listening. For everyone listening, you can visit our Instagram for images of all the artworks we've discussed in today's episode. And we will be back very soon. Oh, and Nick, are you on Instagram? So what is the astronomy?
Astronomia is on Instagram. Yes, it is Astronomia Volumes.
Volumes, great. And is Duran Duran on Instagram? Must be.
Duran Duran are on Instagram. I imagine it's their name.
Love that. And we'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks,
bye.
Nick. Bye. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.